Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, it is a ACC Media Days edition of the Nolcast. We'll certainly have a lot of conversation that stems from what Akers, Burns, and Coach Taggart had to say today. So a lot of talking to do about a lot of talking, but this is one of those events that is on the calendar. It's significant in everybody's minds. It lets us know with real confirmed fact that summer has almost come and gone, and that football is but only a certain set of days away.
Month and a half, man. Month and a half, and we are there. Cannot wait to see Florida State kick it off, hosting Virginia Tech on Labor Day night. Lot to talk about today.
So we'll start this podcast like we do all of them, thank our friends at Louisiana Hot Sauce. Bud, we'll divert from kind of the standard ad read for them, and just want to let our listeners know, and this is a little bit of an unorthodox thing, but Louisiana Hot Sauce is now your sponsor of the Atlanta Braves Radio Network, which if you're familiar with sports team radio networks and the size of them, the Braves is really as large as anything there is out there. So we're certainly not going to take credit or suggest that this has been so successful to them that they're dipping their toe more in the sports world, but great to see them do big things, and I don't want to bore people with Atlanta Braves Radio Network talk, but that's a significant undertaking and a great thing to see one of our sponsors be able to continue to grow and be able to continue to associate themselves with very big things.
Dude, that is awesome, man, and congratulations to the Braves for also picking up our sponsor. You know, that's pretty pretty cool. Now, we got a lot of Braves fans here. Probably got a lot of crow to eat on Twitter because I didn't think the Braves were going to be as good as they are, as soon as they've been. And gosh, if Acuna starts hitting, look out. So,
well, not many did. So you're not in too unique of a situation there. Bud, we'll go from one team that has a tomahawk on their chest to one that has on their helmets. And it was Florida State's day, or at least the Atlantic's day, at ACC Media Days. And look, you're always going to do a podcast about these things and talk about what we can take from coaches, but I think there is some significant takeaways from Taggart's first trip to Charlotte, for Media Days, and interesting comments all around, particularly about the subject of accountability.
Yeah, I thought that was big. It started with Cam Akers and Brian Burns talking about how Taggart had preached the message of accountability. And I think that was kind of the theme of today. And I don't go to these anymore. I used to go to these, and then I realized that you really don't get very much out of them. You know, you can sit at home and watch it streamed on ESPN or YouTube, and you really can't ask these guys hard-hitting questions. They're just not going to answer them in this format, so I don't think it's a great idea for us to go anymore, so we don't. It's a business. But Taggart said something interesting. He said, you know, I got here, and I was expecting a lot of them to be turds, right? Which I took to mean, like, bad kids or kind of kids with attitude issues or work ethic issues and those kind of things. And he said that he was really surprised that they weren't. And I think the reason, Ingram, that he was surprised is because of how bad Florida State looked on the field and what their record was. So if you're the coach, you're coming in, your assumption is, all right, I'm taking over Florida State. God, these guys just went, 6-6? Or 7-6 with the bowl win. Man, they got to have a lot of problems here with these kids. Because I think as a coach, you inherently have a certain amount of respect for other coaches. So there's no way that Willie Taggart thought, oh man, Jimbo just totally botched this thing, right? And he totally screwed it up. But from his comments today about how he found out that the kids weren't turds and that they wanted to work hard, they wanted to be good people, and they really wanted some accountability and discipline, that's basically what he's saying. He's like, look, it wasn't the kids, which I think if you're a Florida State fan is extremely encouraging, extremely, that he would say that. And we have heard of some pretty good turnarounds for some of these guys in there who are working harder, going to class, you know, can actually help with your grades. You know, if you need that teacher to give you a B instead of a C at the end of the semester, it helps if they understand who you are. You know, and he said, hey, I think this team struggled to overcome adversity because they didn't really care about each other and a lot of individualism on the team. You know, that's a cultural thing. That comes from the top down. You know, the head man last year was thinking really only of himself because he was, you know, 1 foot out the door for the majority of the season. But I think that was kind of the main takeaway I had there was these aren't bad kids. Some of them may have acted in certain ways in the past, but you know, that was something that was allowed to happen. And once he came in there and sort of laid down the law, they seem to really have appreciated it and kind of craved it. And we talked about this for a while. Look, Jimbo yelled and screamed a lot, but in the end, the kids knew there wouldn't really be much follow-up. There wouldn't really be any follow-through with discipline. It seems like Willie, again, like I've said this probably, I don't know, every other show for about half a year now, doesn't say a whole lot, but the follow-through is pretty swift, and you can kind of count that the follow-through is going to be there on the discipline if you screw up. So that was kind of my A1 takeaway from today. What'd you think about that?
Very, very similar thoughts. I'll also say, I'll circle back to accountability. And it was not, you know, the more obvious part of that was what the players talked about having to go to class and having to do all the things that you mentioned. I also think the kind of inverse or the unspoken part of it was, and look, all new staffs are going to do this and players are going to do this when coaches leave. But a lot of the accountability talk was also about who was really accountable for what happened last year and who was really accountable for some of the real slides that took place in the program, whether it be class participation, whether it be doing what's necessary in the strength and conditioning program, everything else. I know Akers at one point laughed about if there was a, you know, some kind of penalty for either missing a class or missing a lift last season. And it was pretty indicative of the culture that was created there. And I think a lot of the talk today was kind of an underhanded point in the direction of the previous staff is exactly how far this thing had gotten off the tracks.
So check this out. A guy with no dog in this fight, David Hale, who covers the ACC for ESPN, quote, "No one at FSU is going to go out of their way to trash the culture Jimbo had allowed to fester there, but man, it's the subtext of so much of what's being said."
Subtext, the use of that word would have made my previous point a little more clear and direct, and good for Mr. Hale. I think he pretty much captured exactly what I was saying there, and interesting to hear all three of those individuals speak about accountability, both what's expected of the current group and also maybe the lack of that existed previously. So, but one thing that I thought was interesting, and to an extent, you know, he named a lot of kids, but at one point, I think he was asked a question, just give us the name of a difference maker or somebody that has a chance to make have an impact year next year. I'll let you talk about the first name that came off the list, but I think there's a decent amount of individuals that have a real chance to have a significant bounce back from maybe a disappointing last year, or really stride into an opportunity that sits in front of them, either because of vacancy on a depth chart or guys, upperclassmen that have yet to really make a position theirs.
Yeah, and I don't think this stuff is necessarily all that new for some of our listeners, but for some it might be, and this was kind of one of the more noteworthy things he said. But you know, he said Tamarion Terry was the guy that jumped out to him. Odell told him, yeah, that kid's a redshirt freshman, or is going to be. So he was pretty excited about that. Kalon the Bourne, running back, obviously we know, was very excited about him. Trey McKitty, Dontavius Jackson, and a couple of names as well. I took the first couple names he said to mean a little bit more to me, just because I feel like he started to realize, well, gosh, if I don't name everybody, then people are going to get their feelings hurt that, you know, I didn't name them. So then he started naming guys who were like established stars and starters on the team and all that kind of stuff. When the crux of the question was really, you know, who are some young guys you think could take a step forward? So those first couple names to me were sort of the most, you know, truest essence of his response.
Terry, LeBourne, obviously guys that we've talked about a lot. McKitty, somebody that I think the fan base in general is pretty fascinated by what his opportunities will be in this offense and how he's ultimately used. And Dontavius Jackson, it's not going to come as a shocker, but you know, maybe he's one of the kids who's had who's made the most of kind of the change of culture and had a little bit of a personal change of attitude as well.
Yeah, so that was something I thought was really interesting. You know, I talk to some people on staff pretty regularly, and I said, okay, who are the guys that you heard, hey, these guys are attitude problems, these guys are discipline problems, these guys don't want to buy in? Or maybe not you heard, maybe like when you first got here, you saw it, right? But who are now different, like guys who have made a 180 or at least a decent kind of turnaround to where you used to kind of write them off, and now you kind of believe in them. And the three names that really came back were Naquan, Nasir Upshur, Pops, who, look, I don't think he's going to beat out Trey McKitty, but it'd be good to get something out of him, right? This is his third year in the program, I think. Third or fourth. And then D-Jax. D-Jax on defense is big, man, because we know what the old staff thought of these linebackers. They called them speed bumps in their meetings just because they didn't stop anybody. They just they'd hope to slow down a little bit. If D-Jax can play and be a leader on this defense and be consistent and take stuff as a professional and really have that full buy-in like maybe he's had this summer, that'd be big, man. That would really help the defense. So I was very encouraged to hear that name for sure.
Jackson's a prerequisite that if you want to see Florida State defense play at its highest level, whatever that may be, Jackson's got to be the guy that kind of becomes the cream of the linebacker crop, something we've talked about for an awful long time. That is your only, you know, real, in my opinion, that's your only real D1 legit linebacker that you could put at most schools and he would be in the rotation. It doesn't necessarily mean that he'd be starting everywhere, but that's a kid that's going to take snaps everywhere. That's not exactly something that you can say about everybody that that occupies your linebacker depth chart, or at least, you know, if they are those type of players, you've had kids that haven't had a chance to prove themselves yet. So the two offensive guys, Upshur, I share your thoughts exactly. You kind of got the feeling that that was either going to be like a ship that just kind of sailed off and not anything that you ever got much use out of, or maybe a kid that would be a real benefit of the change of culture, and that appears to be the case. So we'll look for those three, but Jackson has to be somebody that I think the fan base in particular can be excited about, because he's something that you've absolutely got to have when you project for the most optimistic possibilities of what next year's defense might look like. Bud, why don't we pause here real briefly to thank our friends Madison Social, or For the Table Restaurant Group, for what they've been able to do with us historically, and also take this time to remind people again of the event that we are doing with them from 2 to 4 on the Sunday prior to the Labor Day kick of the Virginia Tech game.
That's right, man. It's going to be a blast. We know we had a couple hundred folks out at the last one. This one is the Game Day Bar Crawl, 2 to 4 on Sunday, the day before FSU kicks off the season. Lethal Simplicity meets the Knollcast. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be the weekend bar crawl. It's us. It's Madison Social. It's Township. It's Central. It's For the Table Restaurant Group. It's Proof Brewing Company. It's awesome. By the way, here's what you're going to get. You're going to pre-order your tickets on madisonsocial.com/gameday-bar-crawl. That's madisonsocial.com/gameday-bar-crawl. I'll also put a link to that in our Twitter page, because that's a lot to type in. So look at the Twitter page and we'll be able to hook you up with that. Bar crawl will include a Proof Madison Social. That's kind of, I like the wording on that, at Madison Social. A Proof Mango Wit at Central, and a Proof Warpath IPA with a special Knollcast treatment at Township. And we'll have more details on that soon, as well as a Knollcast Punting is Bunting koozie that will be perfect for game day the next day. That is awesome. Your friends will be very jealous if you get that very cool Punting is Bunting koozie. I don't believe we have any new shirts coming from that. We may have a different shirt to sell later on. So come out 2 to 4, hang out with Ingram and I, hang out with all the Knolls, and then you know what is later that night? You get a chance to watch Miami lose to LSU. That's a Sunday night game. I didn't even realize that. That'd be pretty fun as well. So anyway, get those tickets. Get them early. They will sell out, so we definitely want to make sure everybody gets in. We want to have an accurate head count so we know how many koozies we need to have on hand, and we'll see you all there. But there's one guy who I feel like I've been getting better messages on recently, which has got to be really encouraging. Because for a long time, we didn't get very good messages about him. And that's DeAndre Francois. Taggart had some really good things to say about Francois today. And look, I when he says something about Francois, I take it at face value because he has shown the willingness to say negative things about him in the past, right? He called him high school Harry. Remember?
I do. Yes. Yes, absolutely. Not like this is off the record or anything. Like, that's exactly what I'm calling him. Yeah.
To ESPN. Like, literally, immature, you know, just selfish BS behavior. you know, not showing up stuff, not being accountable, not being a good teammate, not being a good person around the facility. You know, all these things. You know, being a leader by example, especially, and vocally, all these things that Taggart wanted them to work on. But now it seems like just in talking with people, they seem to be coming around some. You know, now granted, I think I said like a month ago, hey, by the way, some people say Francois is starting to show some stuff. Well, I haven't heard anything different in the last month. So how do you change people's perceptions about you? Consistency. You act a certain way, the way you're supposed to act, more consistently, and then people will start to change how they feel about you, especially if you're a fellow teammate and you want to follow this guy. I think that's a big thing. You know, not going over to the side and doing one sit-up, right, after you quit on a conditioning drill during a week of Alabama week. Not doing stuff like that, I think, is big if you want to win teammates over. So I'm hearing good stuff about that. Taggart said that he is 100% healthy. Taggart confirmed that he did move back into the player dorms. Now, Taggart also later said that was Francois' idea. I was told, Ingram, that was something the coaching staff was very much in favor of, by the way, after his incident in April.
His idea, bud. His idea.
Whatever. You know what? Like, even if it wasn't fully his idea or if it was a mutual idea, the fact that he did it, I mean, as a fourth year college student, moving back into the dorms, and I know the player dorms are different. Save your tweets. I got it. I know. They still have an RA there, right? If you don't think Florida State has eyes on that building, you're crazy. All right? It's the player dorms. The reason Jimbo wanted it was so he could have more control, in addition to recruiting, was so he could have more control over his players and more supervision of them. Now, the fact that he actually moved back in there is good for a couple reasons. Number one, you know, if he needs some supervision, he can get that. If he wants to be around his teammates more, that's a good thing. You know, I know Taggart today spoke about how he's kind of an individual and is not the most outgoing guy at all times, kind of quiet, doesn't make him a bad dude, and has to, you know, become more vocal with his teammates and more uplifting and all that kind of stuff. But he seemed really happy with him, Ingram. He really did. That's encouraging. Because if that's the case and that continues, you're going to have a real quarterback battle here come August 4th.
He seemed legitimately happy with him. I think you make a great point that Taggart at this point has spoken in a manner that you don't necessarily have to put what he says about him through some type of a coach speak filter, or if he's trying some kind of motivation or some kind of unique management of a particular kid on his roster. And I think, again, if we're going to take everything that's said as 100% true, that maybe the most important thing that he said is that he's 100% healthy and ready to take part in anything that they put in front of him. If that's the case, and there's not lingering effects from that injury that we know can be complicated and we know is not necessarily the easiest thing to come back from, then the idea that DeAndre Francois is doing what's necessary to be your starter for Game one is certainly in a much better position. That idea is in a much better position than it was 6 weeks ago, and it's in a hell of a lot better situation than it was maybe 12 weeks ago.
If he wins the job on the practice field, do you think that based on Taggart's comments today and based on what we've heard, that Taggart would have the confidence in giving him the keys to this program?
I think that what you can take from today is that the guy that plays the best is going to get the opportunity. There's not going to be any kind of, complicated math that takes place as far as character or leadership or anything else. I think what you can take today is that it's an open race and that people have done what's been asked of them as far as a, behavior or personal responsibility standpoint.
Now, the turnaround is awesome, but Given his past of being a questionable teammate or a flat-out bad teammate, depending on your opinion, does Francois have to win this job outright? Like, does he have to win it conclusively in order to get it? If it's even, are you going with Blackman?
I think if it's even at this point, I don't know. I would love to find a situation where the coaches think that it's dead-ass even, you know, 2.5-3 weeks into practice and are really having that hard of a time. I'll also point out, you know, it's leadership and it's what he's done with the team, but all that can change in a night, in an hour. You know, it's not only the responsibility to the football program that he has. He could he could find himself in a situation of the law or anything else. It's a pundit, you know, it's very much upon DeAndre to get through the rest of the summer and do what's necessary. But I think at this point it's a clean slate, and that there is no real bias held or, you know, like I said, any kind of complicated math. I think it's simply going to be the person that the coaching staff thinks is, gives you the best chance to win on night one.
That's fair enough. I think I'm right there with you. What do you think that it means that he decided to take Cam Akers and Brian Burns?
So Burns, maybe slightly surprised. DeMarcus Christmas is a fantastic football player, a guy who was one of the few bright spots consistently last year. Not saying he had a perfect year, nobody did, but Christmas showed effort throughout the year and is a guy who does everything in the world that a football program could ask of him off the field. Burns is also a really impressive guy, and it's not a shocker that he chose him. I'm just saying Christmas is the only other option. On offense, I don't know who... I honestly don't know who he would have taken. It wouldn't have been one of the quarterbacks. If you're looking at the offensive line, I don't think you take... You know, I don't think you take Eberle. I don't think that's a legitimate option. So, Akers, you know, maybe from afar, when you look at a true sophomore being the selection, that it's surprising. Really, I think if you're not going to take Jaquez Patrick, then I'm not sure who else you would take on the offensive roster other than Akers.
I think I'm there with you on that. Defensively, yeah, Christmas would have made sense for sure. If you wanted to take Lamonte, I could see that too. I think Burns gives you the best chance of good media rapport, but yet not saying things that are going to be inflammatory. You know, Christmas is not necessarily the most outgoing type interview. And Akers has clearly emerged as a leader on this team. And I know for a fact that Taggart wants him to be even more of a leader, more vocal. And, you know, I think that's pretty awesome for them. You know, if you're Jaquez Patrick, maybe you're like, man, I'm a senior. Like, why, you know, I've been here. But he's not the starter. He might not even be the number two, depending.
I think when you know, those names that we just talked about, let's not forget the second name out of Taggart's mouth. I think Jaquez has his work cut out for him to earn as much playing time as he can this year. It's not going to be easy.
By the way, this just kind of triggered something in my mind. I might rant for a minute here, if that's okay. We don't know which quarterback is going to be better for Willie Taggart's system. We've evaluated their play based on how they were in Jimbo's system, which is a very different system. I really don't think there's that big of a difference in these guys. Like, if you told me, hey, bud, would you predict a different record for FSU if they had Francois or Blackman in the game? I would honestly tell you no, I don't think so. Francois, now granted, you have to remember that he had a year under his belt and was not thrown into the fire as a true freshman, seemed to be better at reading defenses. He generally knew where to go with the ball. On the other hand, even when he was able to identify the open man, he wasn't always able to throw it to him. He had a 47% completion percentage against ranked teams, which was just abysmal. He got bailed out a lot by Dalvin Cook, but he did generally know where to go with the ball, and he has a quicker release than Blackman. On the other hand, just based solely on what we saw with Jimbo Fisher, Blackman was not as good at reading defenses, but had a better arm. And if he knew where to go with the ball, generally threw a better ball, more accurate, that type of thing. But he was not always guaranteed to know where to go with the ball and frequently looked confused. How much of that is attributable to him not having a redshirt year and instead being just a true freshman thrown into the fire for a team with a coaching staff who had quit is very much up for debate. But I'm going to tell you, I don't think that's an insignificant amount. Also, I think before the injury, Francois was a better runner than Blackman was. Blackman is more of a strider. I think Francois is quicker. So we don't know how athletic Francois is going to be post-injury. That's a pretty serious knee injury. Does he come back with 100% athleticism that he had before getting hurt? We don't know. How is he going to run? Is he going to have a willingness to run? Because that's a big part of this offense too. Quarterback mobility matters in this thing. As I've told you before, the staff really wants to get a mobile kid to go along with Hal for their second quarterback. There are so many unknowns in this I don't know. I see all these debates. And look, as somebody who runs a website, I love quarterback controversy. Are you kidding me? This is awesome. Awesome. Clicks all day. But man, I'm just a little bit shocked at the passion that people have for one kid or the other when there's really probably not that much of a difference between the two. I really don't think. And it really kind of confuses me why people are so dead set on one or the other when we don't actually know how they're going to fit in Taggart's system. That's what they're going to try to figure out this fall. This spring was just install, basically. It's spring ball with a brand new system, a system that it would be hard, absent going to the triple option, to find two systems that are more different than each other than Jimbo Fisher's and Willie Taggart's. There's a big culture shock there. There will be growing pains for this offense. There certainly were this spring. So, you know, when you just, you know, be cool with your fellow fans out there. You might think, oh God, I know this guy's got to start. He is so much better than the other guy. It's not like one's like a high NFL draft pick and the other's going to be selling insurance next year. The thing to be excited about in my mind is that now that Taggart seems to be able to trust Francois, or at least his comments indicate that he can, is not the ceiling. It's the floor. Ingram, they're going to have two pretty solid quarterbacks at the very least. So if one goes down, you're going to have another one be able to step up. And that's to say nothing to Bailey Hockman, who might be okay. You know, that's kind of my take on that. I was just kind of like, man, I don't know. Maybe a bunch of practices went on that I missed or something. But it's not like either of these guys have ever been studs. And I don't care about the ACC Rookie of the Year thing. That's a voted award by a bunch of writers who don't actually watch most of the games because they're covering one game in a press box while the other 10 league games are going on. Yeah, so you can kind of miss me with that.
well put all along. So you see it on your website. I see it just within my own personal text group. It's hilarious. People want to plant their flag behind whichever side and make their opinion known. A lot of time to decide who ultimately takes the first snap, and I don't know necessarily that everybody's got to go all in for plan A or plan B at this point. I think it's wise to let the process play out and maybe not have this so polarized where everybody's sure of one option and thinks that the other one is incapable of getting it done on the field. So, but with that, we'll move away to some potential scheduling news. I know that you had on Twitter, or Tomahawk had on Twitter, the possibility of a pretty interesting neutral site game with an SEC foe that I think would capture the imagination of a large percentage of this fan base.
Yeah, that was me. I couldn't log in to write up a little something on Tomahawk, so I just tweeted it from the Tomahawk account. But Florida State is in talks with LSU to open the 2022 season. I was told in Orlando, and then somebody else told me that Atlanta may actually be coming in and trying to outbid Orlando for that kickoff game. So pretty interesting stuff there. But Florida State, LSU, they seem to be having substantial talks about that. I know Clemson, LSU is also a thing that is being discussed out there. What do you think, man? Bayou Bengals, that would cause a little bit of issues in my house for sure.
Yeah, old, you know, I'm sure you'd be able to tread lightly and not put yourself in any kind of bad light with the other side of your family. But it's very interesting. I mean, I would love to see that be a home and home, but I certainly understand the economics of college football, and I understand how much, you know, this program has a hard time turning down a check for somewhere between $4 to $7 million. That's tough to do. So I like it in general. This is one of the, you know, major programs that has a unique fan base that you'd love to have some type of interaction with and be able to share some type of shared game day or tailgate experience. I also like it just if it's true the year that you talked about. I think it makes sense from a scheduling standpoint where nobody's particularly interested in scheduling one of these games in an odd year that also sees you traveling to Clemson and to Gainesville. So it makes sense from a couple of standpoints, and wouldn't shock me to see that be announced sometime in the future.
So we've been on this a lot. Do not schedule tough non-conference games in odd-numbered years. Just don't do it. Because if you have a team that's actually capable of winning the national championship, that is something that can absolutely derail you. Having to play a tough non-conference game on top of going to the Swamp and going to Death Valley is almost certainly going to give you a loss, even with the national championship caliber team in an average year. It just is. The best you can really expect out of that is 2-1. Now, when you get both Clemson and Florida to come to Doak, your only real tough road game in those years, typically, as far as you know, the real elite of the programs, is Miami. I know you play Louisville and NC State in those 2 years, but those programs are more up and down. So I am very happy that they are not doing it like in 2019 or 2021 or something like that. 2022 makes a lot of sense, and as we gather more information on that, we'll let you know.
All right, bud. Had a significant amount of buyer sells sent in, but before we do that, we'll get to just some general questions and kind of some personal interactions that you and I have had over the last week or so with various people from across the college football landscape.
Yeah, so got a question here. Last week, we re-ranked our toughest games, if you recall, and I think I had at NC State as number 4. Behind Clemson, at Notre Dame, and at Miami. And I said that I thought it was a toss-up. Got an email from Trey here. He says, there seems to be a consensus that NC State will be one of the toughest games of the year. I can certainly understand that based on where the game falls in the schedule, which is significant. However, outside of that, I'm not buying NC State to be a top 3 or 4 toughest game. If this was a Jimbo team, I would 100% agree. But it isn't the point of the Gulf Coast offense to maximize talent. FSU has a lot more talent than NC State on offense and defense, no? I'm sure they have some nice pieces, but overall roster composition, I would think, isn't close. FSU has struggled in Raleigh, but this is a new regime. Why are we assuming the curse absolutely has to carry over? The decade has passed. The way Jimbo manages a game is gone. NC State NC State was just loaded in 98. Am I alone in thinking the curse of Raleigh doesn't have to continue? Trey, I don't think it's a curse issue at all. If that's the way we implied that on the podcast, then I apologize. My intent was to say I think NC State's going to be a very good team. So let's just break this down with the question. Isn't the point of the Gulf Coast offense to maximize talent? Yeah, I think absolutely. And then Trey says FSU's a lot more talented than State on offense. I actually disagree. I think NC State's more talented on offense than Florida State is. I think NC State has a better offensive line. I think NC State has better receivers. And I think NC State has a better quarterback than either of the guys FSU will roll out there. That leaves running backs. I'm going to give that to Florida State because they have a guy named Cam Akers. But for 3 of the 4 position groups, I'm taking NC State. I think NC State's got the better offense. I think NC State's going to score a ton of points on a lot of people this year. That's kind of where I think our fundamental disagreement is. I think they're going to light some teams up. I think they'll put up a lot of points on a lot of defenses. Maybe not Clemson, but probably everybody else. Now, defensively, I do think Florida State has more talent. NC State did lose a lot up front. I was talking with a guy who's been very, very real with me about NC State, typically. You know, he told me this year he thinks they can win 8-10 games, and he doesn't think that Florida State's the clear-cut 2 in the Atlantic. In fact, he thinks NC State might be better this year, and he picked NC State to finish 2nd in the division. So here's what, he said, hey, Finley plus our receivers will be fun to watch because the offensive line coaching is the best I've ever seen at State, and Finley should have some time to operate. I rewatched that Clemson game from last year, and they got virtually no pressure on Finley. They got 1 sack when Finley slipped and fell spinning out of the pocket. I don't know what to expect from the running back position because Gillespie showed flashes, but isn't the weapon that Nyheim Hines was. We have a really talented freshman in Ricky Person, so it'll probably be a committee situation. We'll definitely miss Jalen Samuels. Defensively, everybody's expecting a big drop-off, but where we lose a ton on the line, there's talent there still, and our linebackers and defensive backs should be improved, so probably fewer sacks. But hopefully we got fewer home runs and get off the field more on third down more frequently. All that is to say, I think we're the 2nd-best team in the division. And despite facing Clemson on the road, the rest of the schedule shapes up nicely. I think we beat West Virginia and Golden Boy Will Grier handily in week 3 and open some eyes. So actually, who does NC State play before that? So they got James Madison and NC and Georgia State. I do trust this guy. Now, I don't necessarily agree with all of his opinions, but I do think he generally has good information. So if NC State starts 2-0 and if West Virginia, if they beat Tennessee to open the year, if NC State's an underdog or a small favorite in that game, I'm going to be all over the Wolfpack. I pressed him and said, hey, man, you don't think you're going to suffer more in run defense, losing 4 draft picks to the NFL on the defensive line, which I do. this is where I kind of disagree with him, but he did give me some good names. He said, look, Arundis Bryant is a name I think folks will hear a lot more of. He's a monster in the middle of the defensive line. Had 2 sacks with Lamar Jackson last year. We'll be better against the run is from our linebackers, I hope. Clemson's go-ahead score late last year was on an 80-yard run. One of the backers didn't fill the gap properly. Similar score against Notre Dame. I think the line will actually be very good. There's a lot of guys here who played just as many snaps as the guys who got drafted last year. It could be spectacular, but we should be more effective defense overall, not so much feast or famine. So, anyway, that's interesting. That combined with some other stuff I've read from David Hale on the ESPN Facebook page that he runs, his own personal Facebook page, since ESPN, for some reason, doesn't let people blog about the ACC anymore, along with my advanced reading of NC State preview from Bill Connolly, because I get to do that because I work with the guy. I'm going to stick with NC State being the fourth toughest game. I think that's a true coin flip game, and I'd put FSU's chances to win that at about 50%.
We referenced this throughout the process last week that was kind of maybe the one continuing theme is that we talked about how much of a challenge that game could be. And just to go back to the original question posed, you can say like the NC State curse, and certainly there's losses throughout this program over the last 20, 25 years, but that's not, you know, completely unexplainable. The stadium's built in the way it is. For my opinion, outside of Clemson, it's probably the most, it's probably the best atmosphere when it's right. It's really, really right. And when you're a program like Florida State, you have to realize the contribution that you make to the other team's fans, and that you're going to get, one of the two or three better atmospheres that they produce every year. And when you match that with the stadium and the construction, or the way that stadium's constructed and the way it retains noise, it's just an intimidating place. It can be a place that's, you know, one of the more disruptive atmospheres that you can find in this conference. And like we talked about, I'd say 7 times out of 10, maybe 8 times out of 10, normally you could make a blanket statement that Florida State's roster is overall more talented, but I'm not sure that's necessarily correct, particularly if you're comparing the offensive sides of each teams against each other. So it's a good question. You gave a lot of insightful information, but it's not just completely coincidence that Florida State has the challenges that it does up there. There's some real legitimate explanations for it.
They're going to play 8 top 40 teams. That's tough, man. And NC State is definitely one of those, and that is a very tough environment to play in, I know. Especially when that crowd's jacked up, which somehow for FSU they always are.
Oh, when it's right, it's real right. Absolutely.
That's kind of one of those things I do think that's like, if you're not an ACC person, you probably don't get it. You know, if you came from covering the SEC and all of a sudden you work for an ACC website now, you're probably going to blow that off and just talking out your behind on that. Until you get up there, and especially if you go down to the field level, it's very loud. So
if you get a night game and the crowd's in the right manner, and you got plastic bags flying over your shoulder, you'll appreciate the atmosphere that Raleigh can present.
You want to go to buy or sell?
Let's buy or sell this thing, absolutely, bud.
All right, we got what are these? 8 of these tonight. We had so many people send these in; it was great. I asked for them on Twitter today, and people sent us in, and it only took like 10 minutes to get a bunch of good ones.
First one is, Bud, buy or sell the idea that Florida State is bowl eligible by Halloween.
Ooh, okay. So let's set the table for the listeners who are hopefully driving, because they have all these hands-free laws now. We really appreciate you all listening and not tweeting and texting on your cell phones while you do it. So FSU schedule and before Halloween. So which games are before Halloween? Vatek, Samford, at Syracuse, host Nord Illinois, at Louisville, at Miami, host Wake, and host Clemson. And then we get Halloween after Clemson. So that is 8 games, Ingram. So in order for this to happen, FSU's got to go 6-2 or better. Hosting Vatek, hosting Samford, at Cuse, hosting Nord Illinois, at Louisville, at Miami, hosting Wake, hosting Clemson. That's a pretty good question.
It is a good question. It's a question that I think I can buy and not necessarily have to put the Homer glasses on. That is a challenging stretch of schedule, but it certainly is not the the stretch that sits immediately after it when you're looking at traveling to Raleigh to South Bend, hosting BC, and then hosting Florida. So I think I'm going to buy this, and I don't think I'm necessarily doing it because it's what I would prefer to see.
So looking at my numbers here, I plugged them into a win distribution model, and it looks like I'm giving FSU a 57% chance of being 6-2 after the Clemson game. So I guess that's a 43% chance of selling, 57% chance of buying. So I'm going to go ahead and buy here, but I don't think that's a lock. That's an interesting one, though.
Very interesting. I think it's a great question. I also think it'll be a definitive point that we can judge the season and have some kind of ideas to where we are, because we know the final four games, and what Florida State does in its eight games will be very interesting to see what kind of position they put themselves in and what they can ultimately achieve in Taggart's first year.
No doubt about it. All right, here's one for you. FSU will be eliminated from the division race before Halloween. Ooh, man, somebody wasn't real happy at Pros and Complete today.
So, I'm going to potentially contradict myself, and I will... So I get the Clemson game here, yeah. So I will buy the idea that they're eliminated. I think they'll have two conference losses, one of which will be to Clemson, which would mean that they would, have to go and lose that many games plus an extra one. So they may not be mathematically eliminated at this point, but I would love to see a situation where this is not the case. But if you make me choose one or the other, I'm going to buy the idea that Florida State will be out of the race by Halloween.
Damn it, Ingram, you took my technicality I was going to go there with, but I'm still going to use it. So after the Florida State game, Clemson still has Louisville, Boston College, and Duke. Now, granted, the chance that they go 2-1 or 3-0 in those is probably really good. But I'm going to say, because eliminated means you're done. So I'm going to go ahead and sell this. I don't think they'll be done by the next week, potentially. Maybe certainly by the next week, I think they will be. But I don't think they'll be totally out of it by Halloween. I think there's still potential for them to do something. Hashtag do something.
Do something. Do it. Florida State is more likely to miss a bowl than go 12-0.
I'm buying this all day. Now, look, here's the thing. Neither of these things are likely to happen. In fact, looking at my own numbers here, I give this a 96% chance that neither of these things happen. I don't believe Florida State's going to miss a bowl, and I damn sure don't believe they're going to go 12-0. However, I do think that they're a lot more likely to miss a bowl than go 12-0. If we're judging the two extremes, I do think that the miss a bowl is more likely than 12-0 for this reason. Florida State does not have the talent. They have too much talent to miss a bowl. But they don't have I don't think they have enough talent in the right spots to go 12-0 against this schedule. And if that talent is not on the field, meaning if they catch it, like the only way either of these two things happen is just incredible luck to go 12-0 or some injury luck that's clustered at positions at which you are already not very deep. I think that's probably the more likely scenario of these two extreme outlier, both of which are very unlikely in totality. So I'm going to go ahead and buy that they are more likely to miss a bowl than go 12-0. But again, I don't want the hater tag necessarily, although I really don't care that much. I don't think either of these two things are going to happen.
I will sell this idea. I think that you've got the fact that you talked about earlier that the floor's been risen at the quarterback position in the manner that it has. The only way that I see this becoming a legit concern is if you have a concentrated series of injuries at the offensive line position, offensive tackle in particular. I'd have a real hard time seeing a situation as you did in your mathematic notation that I will not even begin to dabble in. I don't see a situation where Florida State is necessarily flirting with either of these ideas, but in my own opinion, I think it's more likely that Florida State runs the table than they do miss a bowl.
All right. Okay. I'm understanding that.
This buy or sell is just bringing out so much, organic disagreement. So a lovely thing. Lovely thing.
It is, man.
All right. The fourth one is Willie wins Willie has more wins after year three than Jimbo at A&M. That's a little bit clunky, but Florida State has more success in Willie's first 3 years than Jimbo did in his first 3 years at A&M. I'm confused as hell. I'm going to let you take this one.
I think what this means is who's going to win more games in their first 3 years, Jimbo at A&M or Willie at FSU?
Gotcha. I thought, okay, so the back half of that made me think that we were comparing Fisher's first 3 years.
This is my fault, folks. I copy-pasted this in here. Kind of weird.
So let's tack the first part of it. Just head-to-head, what they're doing at their own respective institutions in the first 3 years. Yeah, I'll take that Willie has more Ws than Jimbo after the first three. I think the West is maybe more than what we just initially look at sometimes, where we just consider it to be Alabama and then occasionally Auburn and everybody else. This is not a program that people necessarily spend a lot of time thinking about, and it's a program that I'm probably going to reference in the next buy or sell as well, but don't sleep on what Joel Moorhead is doing at Mississippi State right now. I think that has a real chance to perform at a very high level. It's coming off its more successful 8 or 9 year stretch that it's ever had, but Mississippi State is going to be a challenge, and really, really fascinated by what Chad Morris does with his first big-time opportunity. I know he's at SMU, but his first chance to play big-time ball with you want to talk about a place that has all the money to throw at various parts of the program. It'll be very interesting to see what Morris does at Arkansas.
I agree. And looking at this, the schedule, the A&M's non-conference schedule is also pretty daunting. Did you know they actually, next year they go, unfortunately for Jimbo, A&M only plays Georgia like once every 6 years, but the game at Georgia happens to be next year.
Yeah, no favors done in his first couple years of scheduling.
Georgia is probably your national title favorite for 2019. If you want to kind of bookmark this and put that away somewhere, because you're either getting year three Jake Fromm or year two Justin Fields, and a lot of that class that that you just signed, which is just one of the highest rated classes ever, will be in year two. So they also go to Clemson next year.
Have fun with it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go ahead and buy the idea that Willie has a better record this year, because if you figure like they both go 8-4-ish this year, I still like Willie's chances in the next 2 years better than Jimbo's in 19 and 20. So I'm going to go ahead and buy. And, man, if that's the case, A&M fans are not going to be super happy. Now, here's the tougher part of this question, in my opinion. Jimbo was what? 10-4, 9-4, and then 12-2?
Yeah, in his first three. Yeah.
Right, so that would be 31-10. Let's do a quick check of what FSU has in the non-conference, because that actually could really matter. All right, future schedules for FSU. So, next year they get Boise State at home, and then in 2020 they open with West Virginia, who will not have Will Greer, because by that point he'll have like 7 kids, and he'll be graduated. He's already got 2. 31-10, man. So the question only asks about wins. It doesn't ask about losses. I like their chances this year to get to 9, including the bowl game. Do you?
I think that's reasonable. Yeah, I do. You throw a bowl game in there, I think 9 wins is very much attainable in year one.
And I don't think there's any chance that they win, or not say any, but I think there's very little chance that, including a bowl, FSU wins fewer than 8 this year, right? I mean, you could go 8-5 in theory. I get that. But if you go 7-5 regular season, the bowl game you're going to go to is against somebody who's probably pretty bad, and you'll probably smash them. So if you go 9, that means you got to win 22 games in your next 2. The problem with this is how weak that 2012 schedule was. The ACC just wasn't what it was back then, what it is now. I know Patrick Stevens, who's covered the ACC for 2 decades now, he said, this is the deepest the division has ever been regarding the Atlantic, which is FSU's. No pushovers, since you don't know the random 3-4 games when Syracuse will actually play defense. I agree with him. 22 wins is tough to do, but if you get a year where you pull if you can pull a 12-2, you know what I mean, or even a 12-1, I'm going to buy this. It's clearly not going to be too much over, because there's not a whole lot of room to go over. But I'm going to go ahead and buy. I think he will, eclipse 31 wins in his first 3 years. But if you want to sell, I do get it.
Yeah. Not to completely blow up the entire purpose of this, but this is a particularly close one. I'm almost just going to push on this. It wouldn't shock me if they don't have equal records as far as number of wins after 3 years. It's the 12-2 of 2012 makes this particularly hard to forecast. I'll take the less bold version and just push on this question in general.
All right. FSU wins a national title before UF next wins the SEC.
I'll buy this idea. I think we got to be a little careful of just general UF mockery, but at the same time, I think it's very fair to, as we have, pointed out the challenges that are going to be in front of that program, and also as we have for about 2 months now, point out that the traction that's needed in year one is not necessarily being found as far as his first, real recruiting class. So I know it's kind of in vogue to laugh at UF or have a laugh at him anyway, but I will I'll buy this idea really more as a reflection of the mountains that they're going to have to climb to be anywhere near winning that conference.
Oof, man, this is tough because I don't think either of these things are super likely. Obviously, if you're trying to win the national title, you got 129 other teams you got to worry about. If you're Florida, you only have 13 other teams to worry about. And that is a big difference. You just got to get there and then win a coin flip game. So I'll sell it just based on pure odds. I don't think Florida's going necessarily in the right direction. I don't think they're cratering quite as much as some people on Twitter seem to think. But I'll go ahead and sell this because, look, there could easily be a year where Georgia slips up and then all of a sudden you're in the game. And then even like Florida against Alabama, back in the 15 and 16 years that McElwain took them there, they weren't like 30-1. You know what I mean? They're like 4-1 or 5-1. So I'm going to go ahead and sell just based on the odds.
Not to interrupt buy or sell, I'll just throw in a little bit of a personal observation over the last couple of days, having spent time around SEC media days. We've talked a lot about Florida's schedule and what they might do this year. Maybe one game that we didn't make enough of or note is the Mississippi State game. It's week number 5. I can tell you just from having talked to people that are in the know when it comes to Mississippi sports in general, that has a really almost a certainty to be maybe the best atmosphere that's ever existed for a Mississippi State home game. Florida has a fairly light introduction to their schedule with Charleston Southern, Kentucky, Colorado State, then traveling to Tennessee in week 4 and to Starkville in week 5. But that could be a game where if Mississippi State has a chance to, I don't know, I don't think there'll be any hesitation or they won't find much much sympathy when it comes to what Mississippi State could potentially do, and if they have a chance to embarrass Florida, they certainly will.
They're walking into a hornet's nest, man. That's going to be bad.
It's going to be an amazing atmosphere. It's one of the games that if I could just pick up and attend a game that has nothing to do with Florida State in the upcoming college football season, that would be one of them. It'd certainly be my pick for week number 5.
And the people watching.
Oh, my God.
In Starkville, Mississippi.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that would be.
They're going to be like, that's not how you wear jorts, buddy. I'm going to show you how to wear some jorts.
I might have taken us off the buy or sell path, but damn if it wasn't worth it alone for that comment. So,
the best place to get ice cream in Starkville for several years running was voted to be McDonald's. I'm not kidding. The recruiting department was like, damn it, like that's not cool. Like when like our alumni say, like, where do you go to get ice cream? McDonald's.
Hilarious. Hilarious.
So they also don't have a Krispy Kreme. They would drive to Tuscaloosa or one of the towns in Alabama about an hour and a half hour east to go get Krispy Kreme. I know just that for a fact.
Maybe a pledge or two was sent out to get Krispy Kreme at some point in time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
LeBourne finishes second on the team in rushing yards.
I'm going to buy this idea, bud. I am. I think Jacquez Patrick, I've spoken about him ad nauseum. One of my, you know, one of the players that I want the best for of anybody on the current roster, a guy that I hold in particularly high esteem. But I think LeBourne has put himself in a place to have a really significant season and has a chance to hit a lot of home runs in this offense.
I'm going to buy as well. Yeah, I especially because, look, Patrick might get more like carries of consequence, but if they do manage to blow some of these teams out, and you know, it'd be good if they could. They are playing 8 top 40 teams, so there's not going to be blowouts left and right necessarily. But these later in the game carries, I do think LeBourne's going to rip off some nice runs, and they'll be long, and he might have like a 70 and a 60, and there's a buck 30 right there just on two carries.
Exactly. And I love Patrick. He's a great player, and I hope they do everything they can to find ways to take advantage of his skills. But, you know, on a play where maybe there's a chance Patrick might bust it for 22, might bust it for 27, LeBourne's a guy who has a chance to, you know, take it for 84 yards and change the scoreboard. So, yeah, when you're only focusing on rushing yards, I give it to LeBourne just because he's got the chance to be exceptionally explosive and stack up a lot of yards and small amounts of carries.
All right, two more, man. Hit me with it.
Treshawn Harrison makes more of an impact this year than Keith Gavin.
Oh, I'm a hard sell. Hard sell on this one. For me, I still have hopes for Keith Gavin for sure. I think that, you know, ability-wise, he has about as much ability as anybody on the team. You know, if he can put it together, if he can learn body control and, you know, how to go up for the catch, when to go up, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I know last week we did not have him in our top three projected, you know, yardage guys, but the key was a very easy fourth for us. There wasn't a whole lot of debate whether it was like him or George Campbell. You know, it was, for me at least, it was very, very clear to Keith Gavin. So I'm going to sell this.
Very easy fourth, and I love that people listen, and I love that people take away, you know, the various things that we say. I think maybe people put a little too much stock in that. I got a lot of Twitter feedback as to whether or not we thought he was a bust automatically. No, not at all. Keith Gavin, I would not even begin to float that term out there with him. It's just a guy that if you ask me, you know, where they would finish, he would be outside of the top three when it comes to production. But Gavin, as you mentioned, I mean, look, the guy looks like a 5-year vet in the NFL. I mean, he's got as impressive a, you know, it's as impressive a specimen as there is on the roster. And if the light fully goes on, Gavin's got the potential to be as good as he wants to be. So I, too, join you in selling this pretty aggressively.
All right. And then we're going to close out on this one. FSU plays 2+ quarterbacks in a game this year, not due to injury or blowout. So good job by the questioner narrowing this down. Look, so I take this to mean, just so we can be on the same page here, this is like different quarterbacks are playing in the game, not because somebody got hurt and not because FSU's up by like, you know, 20 points in the third quarter. Like this, the game is still in the balance, clearly, and a different quarterback has come into the game.
Interesting question. This is really tough without having a, you know, a full... I know what Taggart's done historically, but I don't know if he would be exactly how he would approach this. I'm going to sell this idea until I'm proven false. I just don't have a to my knowledge, I don't have a track record that would point me to this.
I'm going to buy. I think that Florida State will have an up and down year. I think there'll be growing pains. I do think there will be a game or two where the quarterback struggles, and maybe you just need to change who's throwing the ball. So I'm going to go ahead and buy. That's not necessarily by design. That's just maybe ineffectiveness. Although it wouldn't surprise me if design. Like, for instance, if they don't beat Virginia Tech, it would not at all surprise me to see both guys play against Samford or against Syracuse.
It's the better choice. It is. I mean, if they don't beat Virginia Tech, you're almost certainly going to see two quarterbacks auditioned and it opened up. You know, that's – look, there could be a situation where you lose to Virginia Tech like 45-39 or something like that and your quarterback has a fantastic outing, then that would be different. But the situations where I could see us losing to Virginia Tech would be – one in which maybe we would open up who would be the quarterback in week 2 and 3. So I'll keep my answer as it was originally, just for record keeping purposes. But I can certainly see where you're coming from,
buddy. I think that's it, man. Over an hour again.
Over an hour, a good ACC Media Days edition. You know, a time that probably those of us in the media, broadly speaking, make more of than maybe just the everyday fan. But it's certainly a nice opportunity to hear thoughts from a lot of different people. I agree with what you were saying in the initial part of the podcast. It's from a media standpoint, it's really almost more of a networking opportunity, unless you're a terrestrial radio station that doesn't otherwise get a chance to interview the, you know, commissioner of the conference, or wouldn't otherwise have a snowball's chance of hell of sitting down with a Dabo Swinney in the ACC or a Nick Saban in the SEC or something like that. Physically attending these things isn't necessarily a prereq, in my opinion, but it is fun to watch, and it is very interesting to kind of see the storylines that come out of things like this.
All right, man. Well, I will talk to you again probably early to mid next week, because we got a recruiting event coming up. We'll have to chat about.
We've got a preview podcast to do for a July 28th recruiting event. Look forward to speaking with you then.
I got 10 new names to add that I'll be putting on our Tomahawk list very shortly.
Fantastic. So look forward to that conversation. Anytime you guys get a chance to support our sponsors on social media, or if you feel it appropriate to give us 5 stars on iTunes, it's very much appreciated. And until we speak next week, thank you again for listening to another episode of the Knollcast.